Hey there, welcome back to another episode of Bed Talks. I think this is going to be a very interesting show. Kay has a lot of energy tonight, so we will be...
All because of Bill.
He's very excited about our guest. Our guest tonight is Bill Mitchell. He hosts his own podcast called When Dating Hurts. We'll let Bill give more about the backstory of why he developed this podcast. And this subject is serious because the area that Bill does help people to address is when a relationship is unhealthy and how it can have pretty dire consequences. So, Bill, welcome to the show and thank you for taking time to come out on our show tonight.
Yes. No, thank you. Thank you for the invitation. It's really it's an honor, a pleasure to be here with you, to spend time with you. So yeah, we can do a lot of good. Thank you.
Yes. Yes. So I want to start off by telling people a little bit, you telling them a little bit about, you know, what you do with your own podcast, how you go out and speak to people about, you know, relationships and violence and how that journey started for you.
Yeah, we got into this the hard way. We really did, because it started with a call on a Friday evening, a rainy Friday evening, from local detectives who then connected me with detectives in the Philadelphia area. I live in the Baltimore area, but I was on the phone and I knew before I was put on the phone with them that a real horrible, life-shattering, devastating tragedy took place earlier that day when my daughter was murdered by her ex-boyfriend in her apartment. And the thing with her was she was 21. And she had just graduated 20 days earlier from college. And so we went to the graduation. We're very excited about that. And here we are 20 days later getting the worst news a parent could possibly get. So the following year was pretty much wrapped up in learning a whole lot about things we knew nothing about. A lot of phone calls with detectives, prosecutors, a lot of people like that. In and out of the courtroom several times. There are different steps that are involved, which I won't go into now, but we did see the guy who did it. Now, we saw him on graduation day, too. Mm. So it was very strange to see somebody in May of 2005, and then 2 months later, see him in a courtroom when they bring him in handcuffs and shackles in a dark blue jumpsuit. But anyway, 10 months after he killed our daughter, he was taken to prison. Now, he had spent time in jail all that time, but then he went to prison, and he's doing a 15 to 30 year stretch at this time. So he's done 17 of those. And so there are parole hearings and there are things like that that come along that are stressful. So, but anyway, somewhere in that first year, our family, my wife, my son and I were asked to give a talk at a memorial service. And it went so well. People said so many strong things afterwards that it started making me think that we almost had this superpower where if we spoke with people, they would really listen about what happened with her and why it happened and everything. So I really went to work at learning as much about things like domestic violence, dating violence as I could. Over the course of time now, I've given somewhere around 200 speeches and interviews and different things like that. And then decided in 2015 to write a book about what happened, but also include with it advice as to how to detect an unhealthy relationship and then what to do if you were in one or if somebody you care about is in one. So I did the book. The book didn't come out till 2020. It took a while to get it put together and get it perfect as far as I was concerned. And then I felt once the book was out that I wanted to do something else. And I started thinking about podcasts because I love podcasts. I just think it's a really great use of time if you're driving somewhere or you're working in the kitchen but I just was so wrapped up in them and I never pictured me doing that. But I got the courage to do it and so I did, which also made it easier, by the way, later to do the audiobook version of my book. So I did it all and I edited it, put it all together. So yeah, that's how we got to it. The book is called When Dating Hurts, as is the podcast When Dating Hurts. And my website is whendatinghurts.com. So it's kind of easy to remember. But that's how I got through all of that and what I did. And here I am today with you. So it just gets better and better.
Yeah. So number one, like that's an incredibly difficult thing. Because I mean, you raise your child and they go to college. And that's such a you know, monumental event that's happening, right? And you're like, okay, my child is finally set on this path to go and live their life. And then this devastating thing happens. So that must have just took you and your wife to such a dark place. But it sounds like you really have utilized this time to really help others, which is really powerful, which probably has helped your healing in the process, and then writing the book as well. But, you know, she was young. And I think there's a lot of young women that sit in these situations and young men. We don't talk about, you know, the fact that domestic violence happens on both sides, right? What, you know, as you talk to people, what are some early indicators? Because when you're young, you don't know sometimes what could look like extreme, you know, attention or extreme behaviors in a relationship, because you're still learning at that point how to be in a relationship.
Yeah, what happens is that what people feel oftentimes, for instance, what my daughter felt, which I didn't know much about this until afterwards, but I found that from her friends. But people like my daughter get into the relationships with people like the guy that did this, and they come to realize that, well, okay, it usually starts out being absolutely wonderful. And that's because a lot of people who do what this guy did, this sort of domestic violence perpetrating abusers, these people become quite practiced over the course of time with how to lure people in, how to groom them, how to manipulate them. And they know how to bring all the goodies. You know, they'll have a really nice car or borrow someone else's in his case and say that it was his car because it wasn't. But they will maybe take you out to eat morning, noon, and night. You know, they might do that. They might take you to places you've never been before. But if something happens that's unfortunate, they might buy you a nice gift. So there's this kind of wonderful fairy tale, usually in the beginning, maybe more so than the person who's going to later be abused has ever experienced before. And then what comes along is usually isolation. And you kind of, the thing that's so insidious is that the people who have this happen don't get it. They just don't get it. They think that they're probably kind of in love with this other person, and this person is surely really nice. And then this other person kind of doesn't like some of your friends. So you think, well, I guess I'll kind of keep them away from those people, which means you have to kind of, for the most part, stay away yourself. So you kind of get dragged down that path. And then you start seeing these kind of power and control behaviors out of this other person. They start to want to take over. They want to kind of make decisions for you. Yeah, I don't really like your hair that way. You know, you ought to wear it more this way. Or they might buy you clothes, which you think is like great, but they're really just dressing you up the way they want you to look. So there's that. Sometimes as it starts to get a little worse, there are put downs or there are a nickname you don't appreciate that you hear. And that's just to kind of put you in your place. Again, kind of power and control. I want you to understand, you know, I'm the one running the show, not so much you. But you still think, well, you know, somewhere in the back of your head, you're thinking, it was really nice in the beginning. Some of what's going on now I don't like so much, but it really was nice, and then maybe it's nice again for a while. And then the isolation gets a little worse, and then sometimes it starts coming through that there are kind of like threats. You know, it may be a little bit veiled at times, but it might be like, look, you know, when you, the guy says, in this case, I'll use the guy and the girl, you know, because that's the most typical, and the guy being the abuser in this, but it would be like, look, I got to tell you, you know, when you act like that, or when you say things like that, you remind me of my mother. And I couldn't stand it when my mother talked to me like that. So I really don't want you to talk to me like that. And the woman who is being somewhat abused and will be abused even more if she sticks around is thinking, wow, man, this guy's touchy in those areas. I better really act nice. I better do what he says. So you can see how the scale's tilting from what used to be wonderful to not so great. Maybe somebody who is always checking up on you, which you think is, wow, he really cares. But what he really wants to do, he wants to know where you are all the time. So lots of text messages, not just once in a while, lots of phone calls. My daughter used to be plagued by this guy with this stuff. Again, somebody directing or telling you what to do. And sometimes it gets worse, and sometimes what was almost like a feeling of threat of violence maybe becomes violence. I mean, like a punch or a push, or if it gets bad enough, strangulation, you know. And all of us who maybe didn't have this happen to us in our lives look at these things and say, wow, bail out, you know, get away from this person. What are you doing? But they don't. A lot of people just don't. Some do, but they usually stick around. And there are all these apologies, convincing apologies. Look, you know, I lost my mind. It's never happened to me before. I don't know why I did that, you know, but it'll never happen again. And usually immediately after that, we get back to the storybook romantic world that you were used to in the very beginning. You go to a nice place, he buys you a cell phone, maybe he had smashed your other one because he didn't want you using it or something. But it kind of goes around and around. And so those steps are always the storybook romance. There's then more isolation. There are more threats of violence. Sometimes there's more violence or more frequent violence or worse violence, and then apologies. And sometimes the apology actually isn't an apology. Sometimes it's actually blaming the woman for, you made me do that. You know, you said you'd make that meal a certain way. You didn't, and that's why I threw it. You know, it's never that person's fault, but the person who's on the receiving end of it, the abused person, is just happy for there to be peace again for a period of time. And they kind of want to get back to those good days. But I know I've met people over the course of time, since this happened to my daughter, who stayed in relationships and stayed in marriages for 30 or 40 years with horrible things going on, horrible.
What was typically the tipping point in those situations? Because I do think there's a psychological pattern that you talk about. And I think your mind goes back to, maybe this is just a one-off when it happens the first time. Then it's like the person comes back and you say, well, maybe they made a mistake. And then they make good on it for a while. So you're like, okay, things are better. But there's always like a pattern to abuse. And I think when you're in it psychologically, my guess is, you know, that you're so weighed down emotionally trying to make sure you keep peace that you really can't think straight. You know, this person is like sending you, sending you messages. Where are you? They're isolating you. So you don't have a support system. So like, it's like you're in your head a lot. I mean, you're just trying to survive after a while. But it does seem like there's still opportunities for people to get out. So I guess my question is like, what have you seen to be the tipping point for people? And then what do you tell people when they feel like, I can't get out. I can't afford to leave the situation, or I need to put up with it for a little bit longer till my child is this age.
When you say tipping point, you're talking about when a person realizes I need to vacate this relationship.
Because I think people know, but they often get just stuck in, how can I get out? Can I get out and really make it? You know, because it's scary sometimes. Someone can psychologically get in your head so much where they can really disempower you, where you're not thinking, like, you and I are clear in our thinking right now because we don't have someone where we're in an abusive relationship with, right? So we know, okay, I can do this thing for myself that I need to do or whatever. But I think when someone's in that situation, that their mind must be so weighed down with just survival that it's hard to see outside of the woods. You know what I'm saying? Like, they're stuck. Because did you see any signs or gather any signs, like when you were around this guy she was dating, that kind of gave you some caution?
You know, the tough part is we didn't really see anything because she was in the Philadelphia area and we were here. The closest we had that something might be amiss was a conversation my wife had with Kristen over the phone. And she said, well, you know, what's the relationship like? You know, how is it? And she said, well, Mom, it's not the perfect relationship. And however it was sent up, my wife took it as, this won't last much longer and she'll move on to the next guy. Mm-hmm. She'd been seeing this guy for 5 or 6 months or so, and just figured, okay, you know, we'll turn the page and someone else will come along and that would be it. And she did hang in there even longer because, again, he kept trying to make up for what he had been doing. I don't think he was, by the way, physically abusive to her. I don't think she would have stayed around for that.
Emotionally.
Yeah, it was all mind games and you know, they were kind of in and out of breaking up so many times, or friends were just tired of hearing about it. But one of the key things, because my daughter did try to break up, and I guess did that last day, because she took his key away from him and a security guard to get into her building, and he had a lot of his things packed in boxes. So, but, you know, her friends kept using this phrase, "You need to get some space from this guy." And she finally got that message, I think. And she actually wrote that to me in an email only hours before she was killed, that she actually came out and said those words, you know, I feel like I need to get some space from him. But I think when he received the news that we're done, I think it was within an hour or so that she was killed. Mm. You know, I mean, there was no time in between. You had asked about tipping points, and you know, the analogous situation that I've heard from some people makes some sense, but it's kind of like alcoholism sometimes, that until the person who is the alcoholic gets to the place of bottoming out and saying, "I can't do this anymore. You know, I might have lost my job, I might have lost my family, I lost my house, my parents will have nothing to do with me, look at me," you know, whatever it is, if the alcoholic doesn't hit a bottoming out stage where they can't go any lower, they can't allow it, until they hit that spot, they will keep regressing, they'll keep going back to it. Might be months later, might be minutes later, could be anything. It's the same thing here. That person has to find a way to feel from their soul that they are committed to getting away from this person. I mean, I just interviewed somebody a matter of days ago for the podcast, and I'm telling you, she actually was, I guess, technically dating this guy for around 8 years, and there was enough there that I could just say any of us would say, "I'm done with you." I mean, there were so many things that I mean, I don't know how many times I said, "Oh my God," you know, and I'm editing it, I have to start cutting it out of there. I said it so much, or I was just going, I felt like I'd just been hit with another punch in the stomach. I was always going like, "Ugh." Right. It's like, yeah. How does one person go out of their way to make another person so miserable that they're supposedly claiming to be in love with? But from her standpoint, she went through all those years, she got married to this guy, and even that was, it might be funny if it's in a movie, you know, but it's not funny when it's in real life.
You're living it too, right?
He virtually proposed to her. He was walking across the parking lot with her at a Walmart and showed her the receipt of the ring that he got her as a way of saying, "Guess what this is?" And it's like, "You bought a ring?" I mean, he didn't present her with a ring at a wonderful restaurant, or, you know, on one knee or whatever. You know, of course, that's kind of, you know.
Well, maybe my husband did the one knee, which I really appreciate it. Took me out on the lake and everything, but that's a whole nother show.
I'm sure he spends a lot of time on both knees asking for forgiveness. But
ooh, I like
Bill,
it.
I
like
thought
it,
we were on the same.
He's read you very quickly. This doesn't always happen.
Yeah, I have to survive in this too, you know. So if I have to throw you under the bus, you know, I guess I did.
See, what you guys don't know is prior to the show, there was another conversation. So what Bill is doing now, he's balancing it out. Smart man, Bill.
Yeah. You learned. You know, you just learned. I've been married over 47 years. You know, you learn.
Bill was providing marital advice, you know, some of his marital advice of wisdom to keep
your
marriage sticky.
And sometimes it actually works. Yeah, well, where's the sound effects now? You know, but seriously, anyway, having fun here for just a moment, which, believe me, you can use it once in a while with this subject. Yeah. But the thing is that everyone that I've spoken with who's a survivor, they hit a place. The place the woman I was telling you about, who went for 8 years with this guy under incredible circumstances. I mean, he would wake her up to go make him a sandwich, you know, in the middle of the night if he felt like he wanted a sandwich. He wouldn't go make it himself. This guy was amazing. amazingly awful. But anyhow, the place that happened was she was making lasagna this one afternoon, and this guy is like stretched out watching a hockey game, and they had an eight-month-old son at this point, which is amazing, you know, that he even got to that place of having a child. So anyway, she needed to check on the lasagna, and she felt like she couldn't carry her little boy out there because she needed two hands to work the oven. Okay, so she took the boy over and said to her husband, "Here, you watch him for a couple minutes. I need to." And he didn't want to do it. This guy didn't want to help in any possible way. It was all about domination for him. And so you're not going to tell him to do anything. She walked over and she sat the boy on this guy's stomach since he was laying kind of flat out watching this game. And I guess he's watching the game and not paying attention to his son. And the son tilts backwards and falls back. And the little kid's head hits this guy right in the nose. Hmm. And anybody who's been banged on the nose knows that really hurts. And so he clobbers this 8-month-old and knocks him flying across the room. And his wife had just walked back in and saw this. Anyway, for her, that did it. After all the things she'd been through, and you'll have to hear the episode, but after all the things, she said, it was one thing that this man abused me. It was another thing to abuse my child. And that did it. Now, he would mouth off at this kid and say all kinds of things that act cruel and leave him somewhere for too long. I mean, he did plenty of things. But when he clobbered this kid and sent him flying, then she knew she needed to make plans. And that's also when all these people who kept telling her, don't marry this guy or get out of that marriage, that's when she called upon them and they really rescued her. So she's a much happier lady. But the little boy's now 7 and... But unfortunately, in terms of custody and all, it's like a 50-50 deal. So she, half of the week, the boy has to be with his horrible father, and then the other half with his loving mother. And that's just the way that worked out. It's tough.
Now, let me ask you something, Bill. You know, you made some points about overbearingness as far as if, you know, someone that you're dating or someone that you're in a relationship with is always texting, trying to see where you are, dropping in, every so often. Now, in this unfortunate incident, you know, it led to an unfortunate situation. Now, what would you say to, you know, individuals who are in a relationship and maybe, I don't know, maybe their guy, he's loving, but he's always chiming in. He always wants to know where she's at. And I don't know if that would be considered control or not. What would you say to, I don't know, couples or individuals that are in relationships that may have that happening? I just don't want people think, oh, well, she's texting me all the time, or he's texting me all the time, or they're always trying to find out where my location is and so forth. I don't want to misconstrue that with, oh, this must be an abusive person or a controlling individual. How would you address that?
You know, I've talked with a lot of domestic violence agency counselors, and it is a tough call sometimes. But when someone goes through kind of a checklist of warning signs, and if you were, let's say you saw 15 warning signs, okay? And if the person who might be being abused checks them all off, and not only checks them off and says, every one of these things happens all the time, you're probably in the loser's circle on that one. You probably are dealing with somebody who is just over the top. You know, they're and they are kind of like a ticking time bomb, because if the person who's being abused starts pushing back in those areas, that's not going to go over very well with the person who's pushing this on this other person, because the whole object here, again, is power and control. And when the message starts coming back that your power and control over me isn't working anymore, then the person who's the abuser basically panics. They have their own version now of anxiety and panicking about, whoa, this person's trying to get away. You know, we can't let this happen. But it's a matter of degrees, because, yeah, you know, some of these things are interesting, because if somebody's checking up on you, it may be that they care, you know, that they just care. You know, they're, how are you coming along with shopping and things like that? I mean, it's not always so bad, because if you look at a lot of these and say that, oh, you know, this guy I'm dating doesn't do any of this stuff. Like, so he never takes you to nice places. That's not so good. Well, he never gives me gifts. That doesn't mean this. He's fabulous. It's just when somebody's doing these things over the top, you know, it gets to the point, like my daughter used the term annoying. He was so annoying. When it gets to that point, it's too much. And that's why her friends, and finally she said, you get some space, you know, like, I mean, she went away about a week before she was killed, but she went away with a friend of hers who she'd known for a couple of years in college. And they went to the New Jersey shore. And her, so this person that she went to go to the house with, kind of a beach house, if I remember this correctly, and I know this sounds crazy, but I know that this other girl, her name is Samantha, that her parents were very well-to-do. They were lawyers. And from what I understand, they bought a house that used to belong to Allen Iverson. Okay. He was an NBA star.
Yes, we're familiar.
So you know this is not some shack, some shack by the sand there, you know, with the seagrass. Mm-hmm. So a really nice place. And the idea was that it was Memorial Day weekend. So they went there on a Friday. They're going to be there Friday night, Saturday, Sunday, and Monday. And Kristen's still boyfriend at that moment, he wanted no parts of that. So he was just peppering her with text messages all of Friday into Saturday. Mm-hmm. And he finally gave her some big boo-hoo pouting story. And she gave in, and he drove to the beach house and picked her up and wrecked the whole weekend. Pulled the whole rug out from under.
So that was a sign that he couldn't even give her space. Like, that's a huge sign, actually. And that her friends around her were having the consistently same observation of his behavior. Like, sometimes we know when you start dating, you're all in love and you spend a lot of time with that person.
Which I was going to address. Yes.
Yeah. Which I think that's a normal part of a relationship.
And it's cute at that moment. Yeah. You know, if she's checking up on him, you know, throughout the day and vice versa, you know, that's a part of the elation of, you know, of the relationship, you know,
but when showing you care and
But when things start to amplify and like you said, I guess you create your checklist of, you know, the abuses that possibly have taken place, whether verbal abuse, emotional abuse, controlling factors, you know, you start checking those things off. I think that takes a little bit of the love, you know, out of the air.
And I think the fact that he didn't want her to have that space, because I think she would have started thinking, and she was already thinking that she had wrote to you guys, right? Like, she wanted to take space, you know, close to the time she passed away. But then before that, she probably was considering it in her mind and trying to get that space with her friend. And her friend was probably saying, come away so you could see. But this guy was just constantly in her head, like, didn't want to, you know, he wanted to keep that connection there. Because it's like, once you break that connection, and you see something, you could see it clearly a lot of times when you're away from something. But it was like he was just determined to, like...
Yeah, I think that's what they wanted, her to get some objectivity, yes. Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious, you know, had she dealt with any abuse leading up to her wanting to, you know, to remove herself from the relationship? In other words, I know there was verbal abuse, there were controlling factors. Was there any physical abuse prior to the unfortunate incident?
I am under the strong impression there wasn't any. You know, one of the things that a number of her friends said after she was gone, friends from high school and friends up there said, and they meant this as a compliment because it won't sound like it immediately, but they said she was such a coward. And what they meant was when somebody was around who was getting physical or somebody was becoming too much, too loud or violent, she wanted to just get out of there. She wanted no parts of it. You know, she was just a very gentle soul. So, you know, I say that because the cover story the guy used when he was finally, when the detectives police caught up with him, was that from a violence standpoint, she started it. Okay, so that it was kind of a, evidently, we only have one side of the story, but evidently pushing and shoving in her kitchen. And unfortunately, there was a block of steak knives in the kitchen. And so supposedly he pushed her, which he admitted. And when he was pulling her, she was trying to grab for anything and unfortunately grabbed the block of steak knives, which means that they all kind of came back and they were around. And so I guess he was trying to pin her down, and somewhere along the way, supposedly she picked up one and she cut him on his neck or something like that. And so he tried to portray it as self-defense is where this is going. Mm-hmm. And he had to defend himself. And her friends, all of them said, there's no way on earth that she would ever do something like that to another person under any circumstances. And I agree with that. She was just a very, very peaceful person, but she wouldn't initiate a fight, let alone initiating a violent fight. That was not her at all. So,
which kind of speaks to an abuser. They usually are going to go after someone they think is more demure or more laid back or more resistant to conflict. Because they can.
That's a very good point. The people who do this, and you know, sometimes it's trial and error trying to find the right person. But yeah, they try to find somebody who's really nice and makes a good appearance. Somebody who has a job. You know, like somebody who's stable is what I'm saying. But they want to find somebody who's a little bit of a prize who will put up with their stuff. And unfortunately, she was a good candidate for that. And she hung in there as long as she could stand it. And then just like, you know, I think she reached the point where she thought, I'm going to be starting my new job soon. She had won a job a couple semesters before, but it wasn't starting until the summer. And she was killed in June. So she had a job with General Mills just outside of Philadelphia. And it wasn't some amazing job. It was just like a sales rep job. But she was going to get a car and do stuff. You know, I mean, she would have probably, we always thought she'd do that for a couple of years and then do something she probably wanted to do more. But still, General Mills isn't
a great company
thing to write on your resume. And I think that she was looking ahead, that she was starting in about 3 weeks. And I think that she probably looked at her life and thought, what's really working and what is baggage? And this guy was clearly baggage at this point. And I just think he lost it. Yeah, he just lost it. He couldn't stand the idea that she was out of his life. And you know, one thing that's interesting, by the way, is she died in 2005. It probably was 8 years later when through Facebook, a young woman showed up, you know, in a text message or instant message. You know, somehow this woman kind of came out of no place. And darn if I didn't find out that it's the woman who dated this guy prior to my daughter.
Oh, wow.
She actually came through that way. And so we have been in contact for, I guess, about 9 years now. And so, you know, it's we'll never be able to speak with Kristen about what it was like to be around him. But this other woman is an open book. So it's interesting. And of course, she looked at our situation like, wow, she said that really could have been me. The day that this other woman, the day that she, let's see, she was married on a Saturday on June 4th of 2005. So Kristen died on June 3rd, 2005. The following day, this other woman who had dated this guy was married. And then the next day on Sunday found out that here's this guy that she had dated about a year earlier had killed somebody. Mm. And here she had dated this guy. Wow. And of course, the first thought has to be, it could have been me.
Yes. Yep.
Let me ask you something. There's an old saying in the urban, you know, community that even a rose can grow in the concrete jungle. And what that simply implies is, you know, no matter how poverty stricken you are, no matter how poverty stricken your area that you reside in is, you know, there are times where you can still find a rose in that environment. In lieu of this tragedy, because one thing I've learned just in some of the menial episodes of struggles and loss and so forth, but nothing to your magnitude, of course, but I've learned that there's a positive that we can still glean from and find. Now, you started this podcast, you've written books, you've done a number of things in lieu of this unfortunate tragedy. I'm really curious, dealing with what you and your wife had to deal with, what did this drive you to? I know you've done the podcast, But what did it drive you to? Like, what mindset did it drive you to? Did it drive you closer to faith? Did it drive you closer to anger? Did it drive you closer to, I don't know, what, you know, anything that could benefit you to help you cope or to get through this? What did this drive you to?
Wow, that's a great question. Thank you. I think it drove me to a lot of things. I was fortunate because, like anybody who has faith, I think sometimes you're kind of like really with it and in tune with it. Sometimes it's slipping through your fingers a little bit and you have to kind of wake yourself up to it. I was on a real momentum, a positive momentum shift when this happened. So the way I likened it, it's one thing to run up and hit a brick wall or walk up and hit a brick wall, but I ran up and hit that brick wall. So I was very fortunate that I had a head of momentum about God and faith and what's important in Jesus or whatever you want to call it, you know, that force that's out there. I had that going into this, and I'm really glad I did. And I think in different ways, my wife and my son, they had some momentum going into this too, even though none of us knew it was coming our way, but nobody faltered. And I know that my faith or my feelings about why we're here and, you know, do we have a purpose and things like that. I mean, a lot of people don't know what their purpose is really. And they keep trying to search for it and they're frustrated and they feel like they're wasting time. Boy, I tell you, I was handed my purpose, you know, when I got that phone call from detectives and they told me what was going on. And the night that I got the word, you know, I learned at a supermarket, a grocery store. That's where I met up with the detectives. And then I came home with it. Anyway, I don't want to go too many details, but I was the one that had to kind of break the news to my wife and son and my parents. My wife's parents were not living at that time. So I did it all at our house here. But when I had gotten through it, and we all had a good cry, I said that somewhere in the midst of this, there's an opportunity and a responsibility, and I don't know what it is. And boy, it really turned out to be that. The one thing is this that I learned, as I was saying earlier about giving a talk at a memorial service, and the reception afterwards was so strong that I felt like somehow this is what I need to do. Now, you can't just force yourself on people to, you know, like, hey, you know, let me give a speech. You know, they kind of have to ask you. And I was fortunate because those things started to happen a little more. And the other part of it too, by the way, I should say, is I was kind of a little bit afraid to give speeches because I knew that the question would come, why did these things happen? And I didn't know. I mean, back in that first year, I didn't know all the things I know today. I wasn't spending a lot of time with domestic violence agency counselors and domestic violence agency directors. Some of these people are my best friends nowadays. So I kept saying to them, I can't really get up and give a talk if when we open up at the end for Q&A, I don't have the A, you know, I don't have the answers. So for a little while, we had someone from a domestic violence agency kind of standing by, and I'd kind of give my lame answer and say, I'm not the expert on this. And then someone else would kind of come in with it. And I got to the point where I thought, my answers and theirs are matching up so well, I'm not afraid to do that anymore. So I don't have, you know, I don't have a sidekick on those. But yeah, I think that someone actually put it pretty well. They said that talking about this and doing what I'm doing is kind of like a superpower. And I kind of agree with that because I've seen people get up and give talks who have worked in domestic violence agencies and maybe did a lot of seminars and read a lot about it. But when you've experienced it at the level that I have, you can really capture an audience. And I will guarantee you, if you came with me to a speech, it doesn't take very long before that room that we're in is quiet. I mean, you might hear somebody crying a little bit somewhere. You might hear somebody cough a little bit. But it is quiet. And I didn't find that out until I gave a talk at a domestic violence agency fundraiser luncheon at Raven Stadium in Baltimore. And there were, and I happened to ask, is the only reason I know the number, 956 people I guess 955 listening to me. But I got up and I thought something went wrong, because the people who went up before me and spoke, there was a lot of, well, it was a luncheon. So they're like, you know, you're hearing glasses clinking around and silverware and, you know, people doing things and talking to each other. I got up and started to speak, and it was almost as if my hearing went out, because all I heard in this case was me and my sound coming out of speakers. That place was quiet. And so I started to realize people will listen to you if you know what you're talking about and you have something that they can take with them. And so, yeah, you know, it's strange. I mean, I dearly miss my daughter, but I will tell you, I've made more out of my life in the last 17 years than I did, you know, in the beginning, by far, you know. So, I mean, it's good.
That's extreme.
I've met a lot of people. I've met a lot of great people, mostly great, strong women. I know that sounds like a nice political move to
Thank
say
you,
that,
Bill.
But I really mean it. It's mostly it's women who are working in that field.
It's the truth. It's the truth. Yeah.
You know, really, it is. Yeah. You know, people say it's a women's issue. They always say, oh, you know, this is just kind of a women's issue. But then you say, yeah, well, who created the issue? Mostly wasn't the women. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know. I just feel like I'm trying to be at least a good example, you know, to other people out there that you can make a difference and you can put out a lot of good information and at least make some lives better. And I've been told we've saved lives, but there's no way to ever know that.
I'm sure you've been in a room, and statistically, when you look at relationships, there's a percentage of people in abusive situations. So every time you're in a room, yeah. You're in a room of 1,000 people, there's a portion of people in that room that are living some of the things you're talking about. So I do think you saved lives. You may not be able to quantify that, mm-hmm. but I would bet.
Can't.
Yeah, that's why it's silent. I mean, you're speaking as a father, as a male figure, which a lot of times, to your point, a lot of the people that do the work in domestic abuse are women. So it's powerful. And then it's like you live through it.
And you're saving minds also. You're saving hearts. You know, you're saving, you know, individuals' peace who honestly may have thought they lost all peace. And then they hear someone such as yourself who speaks with not only the unfortunate issues, but also speaks in a manner of healing. And I heard you say that, you know, when you're talking to people, you know, sometimes you wonder if it's helping. You sometimes wonder. You said the past 17 years, you felt like you've done so much, and you have. There's an old saying in the good book that when I am weak, then I am strong. In other words, our weaknesses, you know, a lot of times are elevated in strength by the higher power, mm-hmm. you know, God. And so when I hear you say that, when I heard you say that, that was the first thing that clicked with me. Even in our weakness, good. You know, when we look to that source, to our God, then there's a strength that comes with it, even if we can't explain it.
Yeah, you know, and, you know, the only statistic I use at all is that 1 in 3 women will suffer serious physical harm at the hands of an intimate partner sometime in their lifetime. And it typically happens between the ages of 16 and 24. That's the only one. But think about it. I mean, I've had instances where I'm looking out at the audience when I say that statistic, and let's say half the people in a 300 person audience are women. So that's 150 women, and theoretically 50 of them have had it happen or will have it happen at some point in their life. 1 out of 3. And I've heard that statistic said by a lot of different people. Sometimes you hear 1 out of 4, but it's somewhere like 1 out of 3, 1 out of 4, but it's never 1 out of 5, 1 out of 6, 1 out of 10.
Right.
I mean, 1 out of 3 is
that's
ridiculous.
That's a pretty mm-hmm. big number.
That is
that's
a lot of bad behavior
right.
out there.
Yeah. But we so appreciate, you know, yeah, go ahead, I'm sorry.
Yes.
No, I was going to say.
No, I was just going to say that, you go.
No, you go ahead, Bill. Honestly, go.
No, you go. Yeah, one of the things that happens sometimes, you know, anybody that's given any number of speeches, you know, there's sometimes you go in and the group's there, you know, and it's, let's say it's multiple hundreds of people. It doesn't have to be. You know, I've actually given talks where there's two or three people, which is funny, but not at the time. It's supposed to be more. Somebody didn't put the word out very well. So it was weird to be doing, you know, a PowerPoint and acting like you're talking to a crowd. And it's like, you know,
a couple people.
Quite an echo, you know. But you know, sometimes I'll give a speech and it just works. I mean, there's a group of people and they're reacting at the right time, and the questions afterwards are great. You know, I heard you say this, Mr. Mitchell, and they'll, you know, maybe at a high school. And anyway, I did have one where I went to a police academy in Baltimore, and I went there, and it was one of these ones where I won't say it was the worst, but it was like nothing clicked. I mean, it was like there was too much light in the room, which means that I always have a PowerPoint. And the PowerPoint is mostly pictures. It's not some boring thing with all these words all over it and charts and junk, you know. So, because, you know, boredom equals failure. So they had all these people there, and they're all in uniforms, young, mostly young guys. But still, you know, some of their trainers are there. The lights are up. They shouldn't have been. I asked if they turned them down. They didn't want to. So I struggle, and I felt like a real page pusher, you know, just going through my binder and looking at my notes. Anyhow, I got to the end of this speech. It was just merciful. It was one of these like, okay, thank you very much. It's like all I want to do is get out of here and go to work. And I felt like I wasted the time of a couple hundred people. So afterwards, I was walking out to the parking lot with a woman who actually worked at a domestic violence agency, and I told her about the speech, and she said, "Nah, let me go. I'd like to see you do the speech." We're walking out. She said, "How do you think it went?" I said, "I think it was a bomb, you know, a bad bomb, you know, just like it was lame." And she said, "I don't think so." And I said, "Well, you know, I can look and I see people talking to each other." And all. She said, "Well, let me tell you this, maybe so. The people that I saw talking to each other were talking about what you were talking about." Mm-hmm. And one guy was saying, like, "This happened to my sister." Mm-hmm. So she said, "I don't know." But anyway, I noticed this one woman when I first went there. She must have been 6 feet tall. And I don't know if she worked on their SWAT teams or not, but 6 feet tall, black uniform, and she had more goodies dangling from her belt, etc., that she could shoot you with, hit you with, punch you with. I mean, this woman was really like a superhero out of a movie. You know, it's like, whoa. You know, I wouldn't want to cross her the wrong way. Anyway, so I did notice her, clearly, more than anybody, maybe. So when I was walking out to the parking lot, this woman who was walking next to me asking me, "How did it go?" I said, "I don't think it went very well." She said, "Do you remember seeing a woman there that was like 6 feet tall, black uniform, with all these guns and stuff?" I said, "Yeah, absolutely. I mean, she looked pretty intimidating." She said, "Well, let me tell you this." She said, "I was standing near her when she went to the woman who was running this whole thing. And she said, 'You know what? I've been dating a guy for about a year. I was going to break up with him this afternoon in my apartment. But after hearing this guy speak, I'm not doing that. I'm going to do what he said. I'm going to break up with this guy in a restaurant, and I'm bringing some of these guys in this room with me. And they'll be sitting at the next booth over. Mm-hmm. And then I'm going to tell them, and I'm going to tell them to stay seated while I leave. And I'm done with it." But she said, "I'm glad I came to this today."
You just never know who you never know who you're affecting. That's right. You never know. Perception is not always reality. So we appreciate you coming on tonight and talking about your journey. The only thing I want you to give us before you go, because you are a man of much wisdom and marital advice wisdom, tell our listeners, first of all, how long you've been married. And then I want you to give a piece of advice for men and then for women, because we're all about equity on this show.
Golden nuggets. Golden nuggets.
Just a couple of golden nuggets.
Golden nuggets. Oh, wow.
And then tell people where they can find you after that as well.
But don't forget to tell the audience first how long you have been married.
Yes, because that's very key.
Okay, yes. Well, I should throw in, we dated 8.5 years, mm-hmm. and we've been married just over 47 years. And so we dated, you know, pretty young. I was 16. She had just turned 15. Still makes a high number, I know. But so, yeah, we go back a ways. Childhood sweethearts or whatever you call that type of thing. Yeah.
So ladies and gentlemen, that's 50 plus years for all you mathematicians out there. For you mathematicians out there, that's 50 plus years. Okay. With dating and marriage. Go ahead. Go ahead, Bill.
So marital advice.
For both males and the females.
And it could be one thing that's a political goal.
Or one thing that's both, yeah. Matter of fact, yeah,
just do one thing that's a political goal.
Yeah, I'm glad you opened the door for that, because that one comes to mind first, the one that works for both. I think that, you know, I'll use a word I don't get to use very often, and then I'll look it up later and see if I used it correctly. But there is a dichotomy. How do you like that? You're like, I don't know what he
I love say. Words.
But
speaking my language. Go ahead.
I use them all time. Every time I speak, I use words. But a dichotomy, because you have to have a great memory about certain things. You better remember, you know, the day you were married or her birthday. I mean, there's a whole lot of things. Okay. And this goes both ways. You know, because if you don't, it sure doesn't look like you care very much. But if I've learned anything really mostly in the last few years, it's when to let things go. I mean, that to me is I think both my wife and I both have kind of reached that point, not say the last year and a half or 2 years. I mean, you tend to think after all the many years you're not evolving, but you really are. I mean, it's still a cat and mouse game, you know, and, you know.
When to let things
who
go.
Who appears to love the other one more. And
do
I'm sorry,
more.
What was that?
Just kidding. Just kidding.
No, I was just repeating what you were saying, you know,
when to let things go. Yeah.
Such, you know, simple but powerful, sound mm-hmm. advice. Mm-hmm. Just to know when to let things
go. Yeah, because I always think about this. There's a quote I read, you know, when you're upset about something, you need to ask yourself, will this matter in 5 years?
Mm.
And it puts things in such a realistic frame. You're like, yeah, nope.
Very smart.
And you let it go. Yes. So I can think about relationships.
Yeah, that same piece of advice, anytime I face a difficult decision about anything, really, I'll say, well, this, how will I feel if I do it or don't do it in 3 months, 6 months, a year from now? You know, if I don't go to that thing, or if I don't participate in this, or if I, you know, whatever it is, don't purchase this thing, you know, whatever it is. It'd be big decisions, ones that you don't immediately know. Let me see, advice for the guys.
I like your advice. Let's leave it there, because I think letting things go.
Right.
That's applicable.
That's the umbrella that honestly both male
we'll
and female.
We'll have you come back for the guys. Yeah. I think that might
well,
be
no,
some
we'll
show.
Have you come back. If we have you come back, it'll be for marital counseling. It'll be
CK didn't want the show to be about the guys.
You know.
No, we do try to always talk about it from both perspectives, because it's two people in the relationship and two people are making a contribution.
That's right.
Tell people where they can find you before we let you go. If they want to learn more about your
work.
That's
great.
Yeah,
that's fabulous. Thank you. So, yeah, I mean, the easiest place is whendatinghurts.com. That's about the best way to get there. Everything that I do always has When Dating Hurts in it. So the book is called When Dating Hurts. You can get it in different flavors. You know, you can get it as a paperback. You can get it as an ebook. You can get it as an audiobook, only through Amazon, because I self-published through them. The podcast is called When Dating Hurts. And it's on all the popular podcast players. And I can tell you that I've been mostly concentrating on interviewing survivors over the last 5 or 6 months. I've really put a big effort into that. And it's not that that's the only place I go. Elizabeth, I just spoke with her, interviewed her a couple weeks ago. That'll be out soon. And the one that's the most current one right now is actually a man who helps us. He's with something called the Office of Victim Advocate, and that's confusing language for the person who helps us when parole possibilities are coming up. Basically, that's what he does. He's the kind of go-between. He's not the coach, but he's the go-between. So there are all kinds, but I'm mostly concentrating on survivors nowadays. And so you can find me through the website if you are a survivor or if you are... But I spoke with a woman recently who's currently a victim. Mm. I mean, she has figured her way out, but she is not out yet.
Yeah.
And that was very dramatic.
So
and I guess that one's running now too. So.
Okay. So you guys
But When Dating Hurts, if you just
check out
if you just Google When Dating Hurts, you'll find me.
Yeah, so you guys go check out Bill Mitchell on When Dating Hurts, the podcast. And also his book. And, you know, if you're feeling like you can't get out of that scenario, I hope in listening to the show you hear that Bill is talking to a lot of people who are survivors now, that there are people that come out on the other side. So thank you again for your message of encouragement.
Yeah, you know, just one thing that came up in this last one that I'm actually still editing. But this woman kept going to a place of, I thought I was alone. Mm-hmm. The whole time I was going through this, I just felt so alone. I felt like I couldn't tell people. I felt like there was no way out of this. I had to tough it out somehow. And she came to realize that there are a lot of people that would help her out if she would just reach out to them. It had to do it carefully because, of course, the guy wouldn't want to know that. It has to be done very carefully. Getting out is tricky. You know, you have to be very safe about it, and you have to educate yourself before you just say, okay, I'm gone. You
can't. And definitely very strategic, and definitely very strategic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So. Yeah. I mean, my daughter was breaking up with this guy. That's when she got killed, you know, so she's a good example of what not to do. And she broke up in her apartment by herself. She didn't do the thing like the policewoman to go to a crowded restaurant and break up and walk
out.
That
says a lot. A police officer who carries trained and, you know how to shoot a gun still was like, you know what? I need to think about this differently. That's huge.
Well, we appreciate it again.
Yeah, I mean, really, anybody can get hurt.
Yeah, we appreciate it again, Bill. And like Elizabeth said, you know, keep empowering. Keep empowering.
So on that note, we are going to end our show. You guys, please go check out Bill Mitchell. Remember, you can listen to his podcast, When Dating Hurts. You can check out his book, When Dating Hurts. He also does speaking engagements. So if you guys know some organizations that might need someone like Bill to come in and talk about his story and help domestic abuse survivors, he does that as well. We're going to take off for now. We hope you guys enjoyed this show. And you remember Bill's marital advice too, or relationship advice. Let it go. Let it go. There's a whole song about that with Frozen.
Yep. Oh my goodness. Oh, we can make one now. But we digress. Maybe next time.
All right. Until next time, guys. XOXO. Remember to subscribe to our other future episodes on the Anchor app, iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and many other platforms.
Thank you.